All right, we're ready for Mark, the 12th chapter, working our way through the Gospel of Mark. As we have repeatedly pointed out, Mark is a fast-paced writer, and so he's getting to things quite quickly and shortly, and we're going to see that even in our study today. And so we're looking at this outline from L.A. Stopher, and we are in the last section, the events at Jerusalem. And that subdivides, as he does in his outline, in several sections, the teaching, the trial, the death, and the resurrection. We're still in the teaching section. early in the Passion Week. And so let's talk about Passion Week just for a moment. I want to skip reviewing the chapters for a minute, and we may come back to that sometime later. Let's go to this Passion Week calendar. This helps me. It may not help you. It may not make any difference to you what took place on Monday, Sunday, Thursday, or Friday, or Saturday. But there must be some significance of that, in that the text talks about and the next day, and the next day. And the fact that he rose on the first day of the week, so we've got to get our calendar kind of worked out for that to work. But be that as it may, if you were not here last time and you want to make some marginal notes, back in chapter 11, the triumphal entry took place on Sunday of this week. We call this Passion Week. This is the last week in the life of Christ. That's his triumphal entry into Jerusalem. Late in the day, as we mentioned last week, he looks around and then exits the city and goes out to Bethany. Then the fig tree, beginning at verse 12 through 14, the withering of the cursing of the fig tree would have taken place on Monday. Matthew's account seems to indicate it's all on the same day. And we talked about that last time. Then at the cleansing of the temple, that took place on Monday as well. And if you want to make a marginal note there, then the lesson about the fig tree, we label that as being on Tuesday, and the questioning concerning his authority, that's on Tuesday. So on Tuesday, we have this conflict with the Jews, and this is his last public discourse. And then on Wednesday, we don't have a record, or it perhaps is more teaching if our interpretation of Luke 21 be that it involves teaching. We'll get to that in Luke 21. All right, be that as it may, we are now in chapter 12, and all of the events in chapter 12 and chapter 13 take place on this Tuesday. Let's fast forward. Next week, we'll talk about Mark 13. Mark 13 may not ring a bell if you haven't looked ahead, but Mark 13, Luke 21, is parallel to Matthew 24. And immediately, you remember Matthew 24, the discussion of the destruction of Jerusalem. That all takes place on this Tuesday. So that's on this day of the conflict with the Jews in his last public discourse, unless there's some more teaching on Wednesday. We'll hold that question till the book of Luke. Make sense? Then on Thursday, we'll have the observance of the Passover. But we're not there. We're not ready for that. So we're waiting on that. So you might label everything in chapter 12 as being on this Tuesday for what it's worth. All right. Let's go to our questions for a moment, if I can find my copy. And what's the main point of chapter 12? All right. Yeah, we have this parable, one of several that he mentions that day, or talks about that day. I call the chapter simply the parable of the vine dressers and the exchange of questions. By exchange of questions, they have multiple questions for Jesus. Jesus has a question for them, and we'll talk about what those are in just a moment. All right, let's go to question number two. What's the point or lesson of the parable found in verses 1 to 12? That's the parable of the vine dresser. All right. Yeah, the kingdom that should be for the Jews is taken away from them in essence and delivered to the Gentiles. In other words, the Jews have rejected Jesus and the Gentiles have accepted him. The major thrust of all of the teaching on this Tuesday, and including what teaching he'd done on Monday, but I'm focusing on Tuesday now. All of the teaching he does this day, including the next chapter, is a denunciation of the Jewish nation. It is how God rejects the nation because they had rejected God. Does that make sense? It's simple, very simple message. And that's this. And so evidence of that is going to be seen in this exchange of questions, showing their hatred for him. They're trying to ensnare. They're trying to entrap. Then we'll see the warning about the scribes. And then there's the widow with the two mites. That is her faithfulness in contrast to their hypocrisy. And so all of the chapter relates to denouncing the Jewish nation for their rejection of Jesus. That's the point. You got that when we get through, you've got the point of Mark 12. All right, let's start through verses 1 through 12. And if you want to look at some parallel accounts, and we will, you'll see this several times. This is found in Matthew. We'll flag that in a moment. And in Luke chapter, Matthew 21 and Luke chapter 20 for parallel accounts. But let's talk about this parable of the vine dressers. The text says that he spoke to them in parables, plural. Well, what other parables? You say, well, this is the only one mentioned here, and then he moves on to something else. Well, Matthew's account will help us out here because in Matthew 21, there's the parable of the two sons. The father who said to his two sons, go work today in my vineyard. Remember that parable. All right, that's Matthew 21. That was uttered at this same time. Then Matthew 22 mentions the parable of the wedding feast. Not mentioned here, but mentioned in Matthew 22 on that Tuesday. So there were multiple parables. Mark, remember, is fast-paced. He's hitting points necessary to make his point, and he's moving on. So he doesn't take time to deal with that. Now, Isaiah chapter 5, for what it may be worth to us, this is not the first time God has compared Israel, the people of God, with a vineyard where God went to the vineyard expecting fruit. Now, forget about spiritual things for a moment. If you had a vineyard where you're growing grapes and you hire somebody to work it, and it's not just a little grapevine in the back, but you have this big vineyard, you would expect when you go to the vineyard to find some fruit. And when you go to the vineyard and you find no fruit, what are you going to do? You're going to take some action. This is not what this is supposed to be. This is, we're going to destroy the vines. We're going to uproot them. We may plant more, we may do something different, but this is not what a vineyard is for. Isaiah 5 had already made that comparison concerning the Jewish nation in Isaiah's day. Does that make sense? So this is not the first time this kind of parallel is drawn. So anyway, here's the parable. The parable is this man who planted a vineyard and he set a hedge about it for its protection. He's doing everything he can to ensure. The hedge around, in other words, basically a natural fence, but he puts a fence around it to keep other people from coming in, but also to keep wild animals from coming in. Like you planting a garden, you put a gate and a fence all around, the deer are not going to get it, the animals are not going to get it, and your neighbor's not going to steal it. You're trying to do everything you can to protect it. And then he dug a place for the wine vat, perhaps hewing, some suggest hewing something out of a rock, so that as the grapes are squeezed, then the wine has a place to run and to capture. And then he built a tower, perhaps that he might see predators, that he might look out over the vineyard. Perhaps it's a large vineyard, so that he's able to look out and see if it's all doing well, but he's got a tower. And then what does he do? Verse 1. He leased it out to vine dressers. Your footnote in the New King James will say tenant farmers. In other words, he still owns it, he's still expecting, but he's got somebody working the farm for him. Now when vintage time comes, in other words, time for fruit, what does he do? He sends a servant. How is he treated? Yeah, and they sent him away empty-handed. So he sent then another servant, and they threw stones at him. Now, your translation may not say they threw stones at him. If you're reading from, I believe it's the English Standard, New American Standard, any of those that are based on the minority text, that's missing. That's a textual issue. It's a more of a technical thing, and so maybe that's not there. But anyway, that's a minority versus majority textual issue. But anyway, they wounded him and in the head, and they sent him away, shamefully treated. In other words, they mistreated the servant. He sins even more, and by this time they're killing him and beating some and killing others. And then finally he says what? I've got a beloved son, I'm going to send him. They will at least respect my son. Perhaps they will, the other parallel accounts suggest. They will respect my son. And then what did they say? Yeah, we're going to kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. In other words, they think by if we kill him, that now we will have control of this kingdom or this empire or this vineyard that we really want to have control of. We're working it. We're part of this vineyard, we think, and so it's going to belong to us. They have a misunderstanding of what's going to take place. Now, at verse 8, they took him and killed him and cast him out of the vineyard. Now then, verse 9, Jesus asked what? Yeah, he's going to destroy. Now notice the wording here. Will he not come and destroy the vine dressers? Now it's interesting. Here's why we need parallel accounts. Luke's account, their response to that was, certainly not. Mark doesn't record that. Matthew doesn't either. In other words, Jesus says, here's what's going to happen. He's going to come back and he'll destroy the vine dressers. And the Pharisees said, no way. Certainly not. That's not going to happen. You know that's not what he's going to do. Oh yeah, that's what's going to happen. And that's what he's about to mention in the next chapter. Well, verse 9, you might also make a marginal note that Matthew 21, the parallel account, that Jesus said it would be taken from the Jews and given to the Gentiles. So this is a description of the kingdom being taken away from the Jews in that they rejected it. And as Acts 13 says, lo, we turn to the Gentiles. That makes sense? Turn to the Gentiles. Now then, he said, have you not read in the scriptures? And where does this quotation come from? Psalm 118, verses 22 and 23. Now, you may find a little variation between this and it may not, depending on your Hebrew text or your Old Testament quotation there. But this is actually quoted from the Septuagint translation, for what that may be worth to you, that he's quoting from that Greek translation, not from the Hebrew text, but from the Greek translation of the Hebrew text. And the text said, the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. This was the Lord's doings, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Now, what do you learn from that quotation? All right, this was God's plan all along. Very good. What else? Looking for anything, but I'm fishing for one particular point that I really hadn't thought much about till one commentator flagged this point, and I thought, bingo, you're right. Do you see an affirmation of the resurrection there? That if this is referring to Christ, the stone which the builders rejected became the chief cornerstone. How on earth is that going to happen? That's an implication of the resurrection. There's no way if they kill him, which is what the parable is just about, killing the son of the vineyard owner, killing the Son of God, killing the Christ, there's no way he can become the chief cornerstone unless he's raised. Here's an affirmation of the resurrection from the dead. They're not expecting that. They have their eyes set on killing him. And they're thinking when we kill him, it's going to be over. That's what these vine dressers are thinking. We kill him and it's ours. It ain't going to work that way. What's about to happen is you're going to be run over and crushed by the stone. So let's go to the parallel account. Matthew 21. And let's start at verse 44. Because this adds us a little bit. Having made that quotation from Psalm 118, look at verse 44. Whoever falls on this stone will be broken. See, Mark doesn't tell us that. I'm not faulting Mark. Mark, by inspiration, didn't tell us that. God didn't want to include it over there. But Mark doesn't tell us this, that whoever falls on the stone will be broken. That is, who trips over the stone. But on whomever it falls, it will grind into powder. In other words, y'all are about to kill the Son of God, and what's going to happen? You're going to be ground to powder. That's the point. And then skip verse 45, because that's repeated in principle over in Mark. But when they sought to lay hands on him, they feared the multitudes, for they all took him for a prophet. Well, Matthew adds some things that are not found here in Mark's account. Now, let's go on to verse 12. They sought to lay hold on him, but they were fearful because, as Matthew said, they thought him to be a prophet. But there's something else, the end of verse 12. Matthew says, they understood this parable to have reference to them. Mark was a little more pointed. What does Mark say here? Just look at verse 12. Read verse 12 and you got it. It was against them. It not only was about them, it was against them. This parable, by the way, was also about God, but it wasn't against God. It was about the Pharisees. It was about the Jews. It was about God. It was about Christ. But it wasn't against God and Christ. It was against the Pharisees. They were very perceptive. They well understood the point of the parable, that his illustration, his parable, was pointed, and it pointed straight at them. Now, let's pause for a moment and get some lessons from that. One is, here's the point. The sin of the Jewish nation was that they were an utter failure, like these vine dressers. They are utter failures. What else are you learning from this parable? Reckon what all these servants that were sent. A servant was sent and they rejected, they killed him, and they sent another servant and rejected and killed him, sent another servant and they beat him. What was that we're talking about? The prophets. The prophets were sent, they were rejected. The prophets were sent and they rejected. They killed the prophets, Romans 11:3 says. And so there were prophets repeatedly killed. Isaiah was thought to be sawed in two. They rejected the prophets. They rejected John. And then finally the Son comes, and what do they do with him? They reject him and they ultimately kill him. All right. What else are you learning from this parable? That's an interesting point. Yeah, the disciples are not getting it, but yet here is one that gets it. I mean, the Pharisees, we got what your point is, but that doesn't mean anything to them. All right. Now let's go to the next section, which is the exchange of questions with the Pharisees and the Sadducees. We will have in this section, let me back up just for a moment, 13 to 37, and so that gets us down in three sections. Most of that's going to be found in Matthew and in Luke, Matthew 22 and Luke 20. One section there is only found in Matthew, and we'll get to that here in a moment. So let's look at the exchange of questions. So let's get underway here. The first one is it lawful to pay tribute to Caesar in 13 to 17? Now, they sent some to him of the Pharisees and the Herodians. Now, that's a strange group, isn't it? Are you familiar with the phrase, the enemy of my enemy is my friend? The Pharisees and the Herodians are not friends. But they both have an enemy, which is the Christ, so the enemy of my enemy is my friend. They're banding together for a common purpose. The Pharisees oppose paying tribute to Caesar. The Herodians are placed in power by Rome, and they favored the tribute. And so they're very much in favor of it. The Pharisees are against it. And so here's people that they don't get along on this very issue are banding together because let's go to Jesus, and either way he goes, he's going to be in trouble with you or with us. Your people will get him or my people will get him. One of the ways, we're going to get him. And so they come to him to catch him, verse 13, in his words. And so what's their question? Is it lawful to pay tribute to Caesar? What do they say before they ask that question? Yeah. We know you. It's flatter, I take. Do you think they really think that they sincerely mean you? We know you're true, and you're going to say just exactly what's right. No, they don't. But it's somewhat flatter. We know you're true. You don't favor it. You don't show partiality, and we know you'll answer this honestly, and we know you'll give us the correct answer. But let's go to Luke 20 and verse 20. There's something added there that is part of this story. They tried to seize him in his words in order to deliver him to the power and the authorities of the governor. See, what they were after was, if we can catch him saying, you shouldn't pay tribute to Caesar, we're going to report him to the authorities immediately and they'll take care of him. That's what they're after. We're trying to get him in trouble. So is it lawful to pay tribute to Caesar? So if he says, here's the dilemma. In fact, we have a question on that. Whichever it is, where is it? Describe the trap they thought they had Jesus in, question three. So what is the dilemma? Yeah, there's a multitude here. There's a crowd. Let's get ahead of ourselves. Look at verse 37, the common people, the large crowds. We'll get to that later. Large crowds are present. If he says we ought to pay tribute, it's going to upset the crowds, and so the crowd's going to turn on him. If he says no, Rome's going to turn on him. Luke 20, verse 20. We've got him in a dilemma. We've got him in a heart, between a rock and a hard place. They're trying to pit Judea, the region of Judea, against Rome. And so what was his answer? Bring me a denarius. That's a day's wage. Bring me this coin, the denarius. And they brought it and he said, okay, whose image is on that? And they said, Caesar. And so he said, give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. And to God the things that are God's. So what's his point? I think he's reasoning that Judea, that they're trying to pit against Rome, is under Roman rule. Therefore, submit to Roman rule. If they want tribute, we pay tribute. Does that make sense? Judea is under Roman rule. And so if that's Caesar's image, then give to Caesar the things that belong to Caesar. And then render to God the things that are God's. What God wants is your heart and your loyalty, and render that to God. Rendering to Caesar is not disloyal to God. I learned several lessons from that context for what it may be worth to us. Yes, ma'am. Well, that's true, and nor would there be a question about this. The question wouldn't even be asked. But notice the reaction now. They marveled at him. In other words, this wasn't the answer. They thought they had him in a dilemma. He answers this way. There's nothing he can do but answer yes or no. No, you don't pay tribute. Yes, you do pay tribute. And he gave them an answer they weren't expecting. And they marveled. Second question. Whose wife will the woman be in the resurrection? So this time, the Sadducees, that's a different group, sect of the Jews. What's significant about the Sadducees in this question? They don't believe in the resurrection at all. And they came to him and asked. They think they've got a dilemma. And said, Moses said, if a brother dies, this is from Deuteronomy 25, that if a brother dies and he doesn't have any children, that his brother then, a man dies, his brother then is to take that woman as his wife and bring up children in his name. And then if he died, then the next brother would take it on down the line. And so they said, okay, that's what Moses said. By the way, just as a footnote, it seems to me that they're rebuking Moses as much as they are Christ, for what that may be worth. But be that as it may, they want to know, in the resurrection, the dilemma, in other words, is this concept of the resurrection is just absurd. So let's take Moses and plug that into your concept, Jesus, of the resurrection. And if that's supposed to be true, then which man would she be married to in the resurrection? And so what was his answer? All right, let's look at verse 24 before we get to that point. We flagged this in Matthew. Let's flag it here because this is very important. Jesus gives two reasons why people don't accept or don't, or let me start over. There are two reasons people hold to erroneous views. The Sadducees have an erroneous view about the resurrection. And so they came asking an absurd question. And basically, I'm going to paraphrase, there are two reasons for this. One or two. One, he said, you are mistaken. In other words, ignorance. It's not a reflection on intelligence. Some people hold to error because they don't know. They're ignorant of the revelation of God. Here's a second possibility. because you do not know the scriptures, that's the first one, nor the power of God. That is, they don't respect it. Some people hold to error because they don't respect, they don't believe, they don't accept the revelation. They know what the text says, but they don't believe what the text says. They don't respect what God says. So show me someone who holds to error. They either don't know the revelation of God or they don't respect the revelation of God. That's what Jesus just told us. So when someone goes into error, it's one of those two reasons. Now Jesus states a proposition that when people rise from the dead, there is no marriage or given in marriage in heaven. That's his proposition. Now give me evidence of that, Jesus. All right. Concerning the dead, Moses said, and he's talking about what occasion? At the burning bush, Exodus 3, verses 4 to 6. If you want to flag that, if you don't have marginal notes. All right, Exodus 3. God said, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I'm the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. Then Jesus' conclusion, his commentary, verse 27 is, all right, he's not the God of the dead, but he's the God of the living. The conclusion has to be, and is forced, that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are alive at the time Jesus spoke. But they are physically dead. It means there's a spirit that lives on. The Pharisees denied that. So if you deny this principle that there is a spirit living on beyond the grave, then you're denying what God said to Moses. That's what Jesus just told them. And he put them in a dilemma. And one of the accounts, I forgot whether it's Luke or Matthew, says they didn't ask any more questions at that point. By the way, Matthew, Mark, and Luke put that statement, they ask no more questions, at different places. That's interesting. It's not a contradiction. It's just maybe a bit of Bible trivia for what it may be worth to you. But one of the accounts, I forgot which one, puts it right here. That was when they ask no more questions. All right, questions or comments on that? For what it's worth, question number, let's see, number four, that will help you refuting the Jehovah's Witness doctrine. If you ever talk to a Jehovah's Witness, they don't believe that man has an immortal soul, that the soul lives on and beyond the grave. They don't believe that. Talk to them about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And reason just like Jesus did. Is he the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Yeah. He's not the God of the dead, but of the living, right? Yeah. Well, then Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are alive. They don't believe they're alive. They believe they're dead in every way. And now they're in a dilemma. All right. Next question. What is the next question they ask? What is the greatest commandment? Now, it seems that as you look at the parallel account, that this also may have been a question of one being sent. I take it that one was sent from the crowd, and that the question was asked in an effort again to entrap and ensnare. But the one asking the question seems to be more sincere. And only Mark paints that picture. Does that make sense? If I read Matthew's account, I don't get the picture of the sincerity of the one asking the question. Mark paints a picture of greater sincerity. So it may be that Matthew is focusing more on the crowd that sent the man, whereas Matthew is focusing on the sincerity of the questioner. Does that make sense? That could be, someone could be against you and send someone to ask you a question, and the person asking the question is sincere. And that may seem to be the case here. So the question was what? What is the greatest commandment? Well, that seems like a dilemma too, doesn't it? Because if you say, well, this one is the greatest, then that means this other one over here is not important. Seems to be a dilemma. And he answers in a way they didn't expect. So what does he quote? He quotes from Deuteronomy 6. Hear, O Israel. Every Jew had memorized Deuteronomy 6, beginning at verse 4, the Shema, based on this word here. Hear, O Israel. The Lord God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength. He said, this is the first commandment. And the second is likened to it, love your neighbor as yourself. Now, you might make a marginal note. In Matthew's account, Matthew 22:40, Jesus adds, on this hangs all the law and the prophets. What does he mean by that? All right, the teaching of the prophets taught that. That's true. Everything's built off of that. Yeah, every command you can think of. There's not a command in the Old Testament or New Testament, for that matter, that wouldn't come under the banner of loving God or loving your neighbor. Can you think of one? You say, well, attendance, all right, that's loving God. You say giving, that's loving God. Name another. Keep your marriage together, loving God and loving your neighbor. Well, treat other people right, loving God, loving your neighbor. You can't find one that doesn't come under the banner of those. There's not a command. So everything hangs under the banner of that. That's why these are the greatest commandments, he said. All right. Matthew mentions that, Luke doesn't. There's no other greater commandment than these. And then the scribe, here's his comments. And if you're not reading from a red letter edition where you can see the transition of Jesus, if you do a quick reading, it sounds like this is Jesus talking in verse 32 and 33. What does he say? Not Jesus, this is the questioner. He said, this is right. He said, this was well spoken. And for there is one God and there's no other. And to love God with all your heart and with all the understanding, all the soul and all your strength, etc., is more than a whole burnt offering and sacrifices. Was he right? Absolutely, he's right. So Jesus responded, said, you answered wisely. That's how I know he was right. Jesus said he was. And then Jesus added a statement that's quite interesting. You're not far from the kingdom of God. Every preacher's got a sermon on that. You're not far from the kingdom of God. He seems to comprehend the nature of the kingdom perhaps better than the disciples have been. Isn't that interesting? This is not a disciple in the sense of his immediate followers. This is one of the Pharisees, one of the Jews, that's sent by the crowd. You are not far from the kingdom. In other words, he comprehends the nature of the kingdom, but what the kingdom requires is surrendering all and surrendering your life unto God. That's what he just said, but no evidence that this man has done that yet. Does that make sense? Do you know anybody not far from the kingdom? In other words, they have a better understanding than some Christians, but they're not there yet. They know the truth, but they just hadn't obeyed it. You're not far from the kingdom. And this is where Mark adds, no one ask any more questions now. That's over. But now the other accounts put it at a different place. All right, now let's go. Now Jesus now turns. They didn't ask any, in Mark's account, they don't ask any more questions now. But Jesus has got one. What's he asking this time? All right. Y'all have tried to put me, now I'm paraphrasing, that Jesus is saying, y'all have tried to put me in a dilemma and you haven't. I've been able to answer everything. Let me ask you a question, since you like dilemmas, and you answer this for me. Now, he asked concerning the Christ, whose son is he? Now, you said, that's not how it's worded. That's how it's worded in Matthew's account. Whose son is he? And they answered, David. They're committed to that. He's the son of David. But here in this account, he said, how is he, who is the Christ, the son of David? Well, that was the second part of that installment, as they have already answered his question. For David himself said, and we'll come back to verse 35, 36 in a moment, talk about the Holy Spirit, but David had said, and this is from Psalm what? Psalm 110, and that the Lord said to my Lord, sit thou on my right hand. And so his question is what? If he's David's son, then how did David call him Lord? In other words, if the Christ is his son, how did he call him Lord? Well, that's an easy answer if you believe the truth, but not for these people. And Matthew's account said they were not able to answer him. Mark didn't mention that. In other words, they liked dilemmas, but they couldn't figure this one out. They couldn't answer him. We don't know how to answer that. Now let's flag two things here. Verse 36, David himself said by the Holy Spirit. Here's an affirmation of inspiration. David wrote by inspiration. So David was not writing of his own mind. David, and he wrote the Psalms, was inspired. Secondly, the common people heard him gladly. Most of your translations, you've probably heard that passage mentioned, and not erroneously, but mentioned that it's the common man, not the sophisticated of society. It's not the educated of society. It's not the upper crust, but it's the common people, just common everyday folks that listen to Jesus. Well, that's true. We'll come back to that. But look at your various translations of that. It'll say the large crowd, the multitude. That's what the common people, the majority. So it's a large crowd, which would have included the common everyday folks. So that point's still there. It's just that's not what this is saying. It's talking about the large crowd. And that's about to change, though. But at this point on Tuesday, and I'm talking about quickly because this is Tuesday, by Friday they kill him. But the crowd is glad. I meant to go back and do a little more work on this word glad. Don't hold me to this, but I think it has to do with the sweet smell. It's the idea that it was pleasant. They're glad to hear this. They enjoy listening to his teaching. That doesn't last. All right. Now then, the next section is about, I'll get to it, warning about the scribes. Now let's make a marginal note right here. What you have in verse 38, 39, and 40 is a brief summary of the entirety of Matthew 23. Now, Matthew 23 is that scathing rebuke. Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. Remember that? Over and over. Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. It's that strong denunciation, stronger than anything we've seen so far, of the hypocrisy of the Jewish nation. So, if you want evidence that Mark is fast-paced, he just covered all of Matthew 23 in these short verses. And that's about all I'm going to say because I want to get to the next section and our time is about gone. And so basically it's about how that they love the pretense. It's all hypocrisy. It's all show with these Pharisees. That's what that section about, warning about the scribes. Now the widow with the two mites, that's not mentioned in Matthew's account, but it is in Luke. And what we have here is Jesus was setting, he's in the temple area on this Tuesday, and he saw how the people bringing their money and giving, and the rich were giving much. And then there was this poor widow who came and gave two mites that make a quadrans, which is the smallest of the coins. In other words, some translations even use the word penny. Just it doesn't matter what the amount was, but it was just a very small amount in comparison. And what did Jesus say about that? She gave more than all the others because she gave of her whole livelihood. In other words, she gave all she had. This was all she had, just two mites. And she gave everything. And so by comparison, here someone may come in and throw $1,000, $2,000 into the treasury, but if they're multimillionaires, billionaires, okay, that's great. That was fine. Nothing wrong with that. But here's someone who gives a dollar, but it took a sacrifice to give that dollar. The Lord is as pleased or more pleased with the dollar than he is the thousands, is he not? I've known of times when brethren, not as a church, but as a group, are raising some money to help someone in need. And I've known of people who'd give $1,000, someone maybe give $500, and that's great. But I've known of some people who brought, maybe gave $10 or $20, and knowing that they may miss a meal that week because they gave that much. They gave more than anybody. And that happens from time to time. This widow did that. Now, let's make one comment and we're done. Jesus is not condemning the rich or giving a lot, but sacrificial giving. She gave what she could. I think what Jesus is doing is dealing with the hypocrisy in this context. That's his focal point on Tuesday. The hypocrisy of those who may give a lot for the show of giving a lot, because that follows on the heels of the hypocrisy of 38, 39, and 40. And here's one who sincerely gives everything they've got. Here's sincerity in contrast to hypocrisy. That seems to be his point. Chapter 13, next time.